Buddhism, as I understand it, seems to dovetail with my own natural inclinations and experience. Specifically, the understanding of what conditions are there on Earth, the nubbin of it all, or the knot of it all, is, in Buddhist terms, three points or three characteristics of existence. Secondly, as you get older, you realize that everything is transitory or mutable, or as the Western philosopher Heraclitus said, you can't step in the same river twice. Or as the poet Gregory Corso said, you can't step in the same river once, even. Then the other thing is, because everything is changing or flowing or transitory or mutable, even the American century, the American empire, as well as the personal self and the old houses I used to live in as a kid and the streets I used to walk in, everything changes and there's no fixed reference point. Everything moves like water. As the other American poet, Robert Creeley, says, everything is water if you look long enough. So that's sort of the basis of Buddhist philosophy, and it's also my own experience. Then the other thing is that, so there is this sense of great open space and ourselves passing through it, and a kind of vastness to the space of the universe, and a vastness to the timelessness of it, like a dream. And also the realization that there's not—it's not really solid, like a rock. There's no inherent soul, in a sense. There's no inherent ego. There's no inherent selfhood. There's no one to go to hell. There's nobody there to go to hell, and there's no hell, or no permanent hell. There is our own existence, which is completely real, but then it has an empty nature or dreamlike nature because it's temporary. So that's what I've always felt as a little kid, how wonderful it was to be in this big, vast universe, and yet at the same time, how much like a dream it is. And I think almost every kid has that feeling, the dream nature of things. So that was my original experience, and that seems to coincide with Buddhist theory. Then when about 1950, Kerouac got turned on to Buddhism, and began serenading me with it, and some of the Buddhist chants, particularly philosophic aspect that I was just talking about. Now, as a good young Jewish boy with progressive tendencies, I thought everything would progress and things would get better and better, but he pointed out that existence contained suffering. And I thought at first Kerouac was being anti-Semitic or something, making fun of my Jewish oi oi oi. But on the other hand, I began realizing he wasn't being personal at all. He was just pointing out something that was quite real, as well as the joys of marriage and babies and music and poetry. So there's a kind of balance in human life between pleasure and awareness of suffering. So I think that sort of fits the Buddhist bill, so to speak.
There are two things that you mentioned that seem to fly in the face of sort of the American ethos, and one is that things don't necessarily get better, they just are, and the other is that, that's a big one right there. I mean,
well, that's a great big one, the thing, but I think almost everybody at this point realizes, as far as the world itself is, that things might not only be getting worse, but, you know, it's going to be hard to stabilize any kind of order. You know, the old 19th century version of progress is kind of a delusion when you look at the world now with its overpopulation and starving millions and endless wars and egos clashing and people seeking for power and greed and grasping for some kind of permanence and solidity. So the Buddhist view is that it's that very grasping for security and solidity, grasping in an aggressive way, that keeps people anxious and on the run and damages other people. Because usually it's, you know, our security at the, or our stability at the expense of other people's low wages or suffering or cheating or other people. And so the Buddhist social prescription would be to give up the notion of ever escaping suffering, because that's going to be, no matter how rich you are, you can't take it with you. And begin working toward trying to relieve the massive sufferings of yourself and others too, to the extent that the suffering is caused, to the extent that the suffering is not just natural suffering, but extra added from our own anger or aggression or fear or anxiety or paranoia, as you can see in the madness in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Serbia.
What is it about Buddhism that inspired so much incredible art and poetry? I mean, in the 50s and the 60s and even now. I mean, there was an incredible sort of confluence of the artistic world and the religion, I wouldn't say religious world, but the Buddhist world and the sort of psychological sense.
Well, a lot of different factors came. I think we reached the peak of civilization with the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb and also LSD around 1945. And then we realized we could create and destroy the world, or we could create something incredible that could destroy the world, and that it was one world and one planet, and that it was all a kind of interlinked consciousness in a way. That is, the LSD showed it as a kind of interlinked consciousness, as old religions had always said. So, and a lot of people had that experience. And also disillusionment with a series of vast cataclysmic planetary wars, even at the height of technological progress, and the realization that technological progress was alienating, you know, the underworld, underprivileged world, the underdeveloped world, and creating more problems than it was solving, actually. So it's almost like Western Faustian mechanical progress idea of civilization from the Enlightenment ran into a dead end, and we were posed with problems that were not to be couldn't be solved by materialist acquisition. Psychological problems, and so people began looking into their own psyches and found a lot of different things, but that sense of emptiness in Western Europe called existentialism, but which was scary to them because they thought death of God meant no big noble daddy up there to take care of them anymore. But it also put people up to the fact that they are responsible for their own lives and for what's happening to the planet. And so as the culture went into a crisis, the artists were a kind of antenna of that crisis and began sounding the alarm. I remember with my own poem, Moloch, whose eyes are 1,000 blind windows, Moloch, whose skyscrapers stand in the long streets like endless Jehovah's, judgmental gods, that is. Moloch, whose love is endless oil and stone. Moloch, whose soul is electricity and banks. Moloch, whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. And then finally, the key phrase, Moloch, whose name is the mind. It's our own minds that have created this Moloch or mass monster, megalopolis, man-eating machine world. So the poets began seeing that what was happening was maybe a reversal of progress or a decline or dehumanization and greater indifference. And we had all the explosions of the nuclear bombs, and we had the Buchenwald and all the mass murders in Germany and in the Soviet Union, and even America participating in mass murders in Latin America and elsewhere, and Vietnam, so that finally there was a revulsion against the old order and trying to find a new way out. And that new way out could only be by curbing our own aggression and anger and impatience and violence. And so people began to examine their own selves, I think, for try to find medicine for their own paranoia, so to speak, or their own tendency toward irritability and desensitization and aggression. So then Buddhism is very useful there, because there's an old tradition of artistic pointing the way, and an old tradition of a very deep philosophy on this area of the notion of open space and ourselves creating the drama that we make. And then on top of that, there are techniques for meditation and observing ourselves and observing our own minds and emotions through sitting practice of meditation, which is the key, probably. Like when they speak of Zen, Zen means meditation, really. And then there's a living lineage of teachers. And then there was the diaspora out of Tibet when the super materialist, Marxist, communist Chinese invaded Tibet and began wrecking the old spiritual empire. And maybe there were reforms needed in Tibet, but it wasn't necessary to destroy 10,000 monasteries and send the intelligent meditative lamas to work camps to shovel manure and starve. So many of these lamas came out of, including the Dalai Lama, came out of Tibet and spread around the world and began teaching Buddhism. The most active, intelligent lamas were able to get out and learn other languages and begin instructing Westerners in very, very old arts of meditation and arts of calligraphy, flower arranging, Kyudo was in Japan, the bow and arrow, the martial arts, sitting practice of meditation, haiku writing, doha or sloka writing. There's a four-line poetic form where you sum up your mind at the moment spontaneously and begin teaching mind training of all kinds, which had been somewhat neglected in the West except for some of the more noble Christian orders that were, a very small group of meditative contemplative orders in Christianity, like Thomas Merton's Trappist group. And then the Christian and Jewish traditions made connection with the Tibetan traditions and had dialogue and enriched each other's practice. Like, I think the Dalai Lama consulted with a lot of rabbis to find out how the Jewish tradition had lasted so long in exile. And a lot of rabbis and Catholic priests began learning how to sit and meditate, finding a usefulness in that for their own prayer. But the poets, most of all, enjoyed it, as for Kerouac, because the old Tibetan tradition was of spontaneous mind. That is, the greatest Tibetan poet was Milarepa, of, I guess, the 10th or 11th century, who was illiterate but who spoke the most beautiful poetry, which his students took down. And that's the popular, as well as esoteric poetry of Tibet. And then you have Kerouac in America, who never revised but uttered his poetry spontaneously or wrote it down in pencil and on a pad quickly. And is a seminal poet for American imaginative arts. So there was a kind of meeting of minds between the old Bohemian beat tradition, which was interested in examining the texture of consciousness and how to represent that in art, whether abstract expressionist gestural art painting, similar to brushwork, spontaneous brushwork in Japan, or Chinese, or Tibetan, calligraphy, or in poetry, the improvisation, as in Western jazz and some of Western poetry. So the one very interesting conjunction is the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. It was founded by the late Tibetan Lama Chögyam Trungpa in 1974, and will have its 20th anniversary in 1994, summer. So that was a Buddhist-oriented school. That is, the teachers were all sort of students of sitting meditation. And at the same time, the founding Lama and president recognized Kerouac's genius and spontaneous mind as being akin to the Tibetan ideal. And so we called the Jack Kerouac School of Poetry within the larger institute, Naropa Institute. And that's the first accredited Buddhist college in the Western, or at least in American, I think, in the Western world.
What is spontaneous mind? This is a beautiful phrase.
Well, recognizing what you're thinking just while you're thinking it or just after you're thinking it, and noticing your own thoughts. That is to say, the ability or training to catch yourself thinking, and then to notice what you notice, and observe what's vivid, and not to edit it so much as to realize that vividness is self-selecting. If something's vivid, it's vivid. If it's not vivid, it's not vivid. So you work with what you actually see passing through your mind, rather than trying to ignore the activity of the mind and stick to some fixed pre-programmed, solidified plot, if you're writing a novel or a poem. You work your present mind into the composition that you're making right then and there. And you have to trust a good deal to your intuition and your ear and your sense of rhythm. Sort of like tennis playing, after all. You can't plan your strokes in advance. You have to, you know, respond to the situation as it is, and if you have a training in genius, you hit the ball. So it's like if you took your thoughts as the ball, you hit the ball of your thoughts back onto the page.
I was very intrigued by one phrase in Gary Snyder's poetry where he talks about the full, warm brilliance of the mind, which I think is such a beautiful phrase. Is there some image that you can have? You're such a good translator of these things as a poet. Is there some way that you can, some image or some way that you can get like a listener someplace in a yurt someplace who might not ever have heard of Buddhism or these ideas in touch with the potential for their own full, warm brilliance? I mean, is there some way?
Yes, it's the slogan we use at Naropa, first thought, best thought. In other words, your own thoughts are the most interesting television possible. If you're smart enough to be able to not censor yourself, but actually look in your mind as like a television set and observe what's actually happening, whether or not you're ordering it up. You know, you're, in a sense, you're not pushing the buttons or you're not creating in advance the scheme of thoughts that's going to come up. They just come up on their own. But I don't think you'd have to tell that to somebody in a yurt in central Siberia. They already know that. More likely, you have to tell that to a bureaucrat in Washington. The mind is more complex than the propaganda they put out of the State Department or the military.
Sounds like there's a lot of love and sadness in your view of things.
Well, everybody wants love. I think that's sort of a basic. Whether or not they know it, there still is a longing to be accepted and to be darlinged and to be called honey and to be petted and to be fed and to be cherished. I mean, everybody wants that. And how few of us get it and how hard we are on ourselves and are on each other is a matter of almost public knowledge at this point. I mean, you just got to go to an AA meeting and people are talking about they got to, you know, stop, you know, destroying themselves out of a feeling of guilt and worthlessness. And so there's this whole movement towards sort of self-acknowledgement, self-recognition, or self-empowerment, I guess they call it, which is very much needed.
Even though the self has none of its own being.
Well, to accept the fact that this transitory self suffers while it's here, and to accept the fact that it's not going to be here forever, so therefore it's is that that's a main cause of the suffering, and to relate to that fact in a way that doesn't that isn't resentful, isn't afraid, isn't mad at the fact that it's not going to be around like God for a billion years. So how do you come to terms with your own basic nature is the key. And so one thing about Buddhism is it provides the sitting practice of meditation where you have to sit with yourself, endure with yourself, notice that it's impermanent, notice the gaps in between the thoughts, notice the mechanical nature of the cycling or recycling of your thinkings and your images and your daydreams, put up with yourself, get bored with yourself, get mad with yourself, get mad at yourself 50 times till you're no longer mad with yourself, till you're no longer bored with yourself, and then get bored again and get mad again, and just constantly experience your own nature, and then you can apply that experience when in relating to other people and in business and in everyday cooking and walking down the street, that you're at least aware of what's going on around you and in you, rather than sort of daydreaming somewhere on another planet.
It's interesting that you talk about death. One of the people I'm going to be speaking with is Sogyal Rinpoche, who wrote this incredible book. You know it, and I'm going to speak to him about the difference between...
Sogyal Rinpoche.
Sogyal.
I've seen him and heard him lecture.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just saw...
I'm living now, or staying now, here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with Gelug Rinpoche, who is a friend of my own old teacher, late teacher, Trugyam Drungpa. And today we're preparing for a poetry reading tomorrow, which will be a benefit for his heart center. And that'll be a big, huge poetry reading at the Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor, and that holds about 3,000 people, and we're expecting to have it filled.
What's the name of the foundation?
Jewel Heart.
Uh-huh.
It's a Tibetan... oriented Buddhist meditation study center in based in Ann Arbor with branches around.
I'd like to give it a plug in the story so people know about it.
So it's Jewel Heart, and me and Philip Glass are the musician. Have collaborated together and have done benefits here, and are students of Gelug Rinpoche.
Well, that's terrific. I don't want to keep you much longer. You're
no.
You're,
let's see. What else do we have?
Well,
so we didn't get to the literary part.
Yeah, I'm very interested in poetry.
So, I would say I got turned on to Buddhism, say, about 1950 by Kerouac. And then I saw a lot of the Tibetan Buddhist paintings of the wrathful images that reminded me of the peyote experiences I'd had, things that seemed to be astoundingly horrific demons, but really were projections of your own imagination, in the Tibetan tankas. And I was intrigued by those because they were a little bit like some of the paintings of William Blake, or the illustrations to his poems, or Surrealist, or Bosch, or things like that, or Bruegel's images of heaven and hell. And then, so I began reading a little bit, mainly through Buddhist art, Buddhist painting, Chinese landscape painting, and Tibetan tanka painting. And then I already had some sort of like a I don't know if you'd call it a mystical experience, but some kind of breakthrough. I don't know what it was, but it was sort of an experience of how vast the universe was. Maybe I was just discovering it at the age of 22, what kids discover at the age of 12, maybe. Just the enormousness of the universe and the enormousness of my own mind in space and how ancient everything seemed. So then I was intrigued by that aspect of Buddhist vast landscapes, which gave you that sense of panoramic awareness. And then I went on to read the Tibetan Book of the Dead way back early in 1950, 52, 3, which gave an account of, supposed account of the procedure as consciousness departs. And I had a cousin who was a dentist, and I used to go to get laughing gas, and I matched the disappearance of my mind on laughing gas with the accounts of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and that seemed to make sense. Then I went to India. Then in mid-50s, we had this poetry renaissance in San Francisco with Kerouac around, and we met Gary Snyder, who was already studying Chinese and Japanese and writing big, long Buddhist poems, and Philip Whalen, who is now our first Zen teacher, Zen sensei, abbot of the Hartford Street Zen Center in San Francisco, who was a poet as part of that San Francisco poetry renaissance. And old Kenneth Rexroth was influenced by Buddhism, as San Francisco is, the Pacific Rim. So there was very much Buddhism in the air. But when Kerouac and Snyder met, it was like a real meeting of minds, because they both had read a lot of the Buddhist literature, and Snyder knew how to meditate and Kerouac didn't, but they both had a good grasp. And that resulted in Kerouac's very famous book, The Dharma Bums, which sort of presented an Americanized version of the Buddhist wandering fool minstrel sage, the old Chinese-Japanese style, tough kid who can climb mountains and is independent and meditates and is not so much connected with the political center or the money center, but more connected with nature. which is an old tradition, which begins to be more and more important in America as we rediscover ecology and rediscover our own mental nature and rediscover nature's nature and what damages we've done and how to preserve it. So that was partly a combination of Buddhist study, Buddhist meditation, and Americanist ecology and American mountain climbing sports.
Hold on one second. Just let me flip over the tape. Okay, I'm with you again.
So there was that community of poets that already were sort of flavored with Buddhism in San Francisco. And the literature that was produced was so intense and interesting and vivid that it's still very popular among the younger people, generation after generation. And it's had quite an influence on even rock and roll, even up to grunge music and, you know, the latest styles, punk and grunge. So then...
of course, jazz. It's sort of the spontaneous monitor.
Well, the artistic tradition of jazz is always spontaneous improvisation, too, just like with our more recent Kerouac's poetry, at least. So there was this community of poets and artists who are interested in Oriental art as well as Western forms of improvisation. In the Orient, as I mentioned, the calligraphy and ink brush painting, or Japanese ink brush painting, or the West, the de Kooning and Franz Klein working, or Morris Graves or others working in similar images or similar mental states or similar artistic approaches or physical approaches to the paper or canvas. And also John Cage in music, having studied with D.T. Suzuki, certain basic Buddhist ideas of change began opening up American music to sounds that were not formally considered music, but which were audible sounds and could be considered as composition. So that in music, painting, and literature, as well as in film, with the underground films that began to develop what we now know as music video, with jump cuts and montage and quick changes from one image to another, reproducing the nature of what you said, how the mind works. 1 minute thinking about hot dogs, the next minute in the Himalayas. So the whole shift of Western mind and Western consciousness toward a more psychedelic awareness, as well as a more Einsteinian awareness of the fact that the measuring instrument determines the appearance of the phenomenal world, and so that things are relative to our own perceptions. That there may not be a fixed, objective world outside that is not subject to interpretation, but that everything we connect with is connected by our own interpretation, because after all, we are person, we are not machines. And that's the greatness of it. The universe is subjective, in a sense.
One thinks of the rabbinical midrash where the manna from heaven tasted like exactly what you wanted it to taste like.
So it
was sort of a function of your own level of consciousness, whether
right.
It tasted like chicken or it tasted like shit, you know?
Uh-huh. Yes. That's a very good parallel. But the slogan or the notion that goes with that is that two molecules clanking together require an observer to become scientific data. And we are the measuring instrument, I, subject, person, who sees these things. So nothing is objectively real unless we see it and we are subject. So that influences art, naturally. But in any case, just to get naming names, so you have Kerouac and Snyder and the whole West Coast Renaissance group, including Whalen and myself, all interested in Buddhism. And at the same time, you have the D.T. Suzuki and other teachers coming from Japan and Tibet between the 40s and the 60s, and settling in America and teaching. And then you have... a whole art rising. And then myself, I went to India in 1961 and stayed several years and met the Dalai Lama and met quite a few lamas, including the one that I worked with later. But one of the most interesting things I heard was I'd had a lot of bum trips on acid. And, you know, it really brought me down, and I kept being haunted by these trips and thinking I'd had to die in order to achieve full enlightenment or something. So So I went to a Tibetan Lama and asked him my questions about it, and he said something, one sentence that really turned me around. He said, if you see something horrible, don't cling to it. And if you see something beautiful, don't cling to it. In other words, don't grasp aggressively to fixate any of your thoughts, but allow your thoughts to pass and let go and observe your thoughts rather than thinking that they are objective measurements for what's all around you. They're just thoughts. And thoughts can't replace event. Thoughts are not the same as event. Like words are not the things they represent. Words are words. A table is the word table, and it is not substitute for a three-dimensional table. And most of our arguments are about, you know, communism, capitalism, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Macedonia, you know, and the words. So the whole Buddhist attitude of relaxed awareness became more and more interesting rather than tense, aggressive anger. And it did come into conflict with a lot of left-wing theories, you know, rising up angry or, you know, kill your parents. Or Kerouac put his finger on that. He said a lot of the late 60s left-wing activity was, quote, new reasons for spitefulness, unquote. And he was referring to the notion of kill your parents and, you know, fight the bourgeoisie rather than understand it. So more compassion was needed, and that was where Buddhism came in again.
Aha, uh-huh. You don't hear that much about that aspect of it, do you? You mostly think,
well, compassion is the heart of it all, after all. Compassion toward yourself, you know, to treat yourself a little better rather than constantly bemoan the fact that you're not the billionaire president of United supermarket spaceships, but you have a right to live your life without having to kill other people to get rich, or be so ambitious that you have to work 18 hours a day and not get enough sleep and develop congestive heart failure from drinking. So some more calmer life is cultivated when you begin sitting a little.
And now there seems to be such a flowering these days, though, of Buddhism. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I understand, you know, with all the acid in the 60s, I mean, myself am a happy beneficiary of that period. But in the 90s, it seems like lately in the 80s and 90s, it seems that there's even more of a need for this. Maybe because it's non-theistic, so it appeals to a secular people.
Well, that's a key. America is, you know, separation of church and state deliberately because many of the founders were non-theistic, or if theists didn't have a fixed idea image of God like the Jews have, or the Christians have, or the Muslims have, and don't need, you know, Buddhists don't need to fight over whose God is the top God, as we have now, say in India, fighting between the Hindus and the Muslims, or in Bosnia between the Greek Orthodox or the Eastern Orthodox and the Muslims, or as we've had centuries with the Catholics sort of stomping out pagan gods and burning books, or as we have formerly and today with Jews like the Lubavitcher, you know, insisting that they're the chosen race and they got this chosen land and they're going to stay there no matter who was living there last week. So, I think.
So also, that's another American idea, isn't it? This almost a Horatio Alger view of that you can step off the wheel yourself. You don't need some kind of intermediary necessarily. I mean, it's almost Protestant in that sense.
Well, yes, but there still is the notion, even in Buddhism, of a spiritual friend or an elder teacher or a Vajra master or a Zen Roshi. And you really, so the authority has really shifted to a human being taking responsibility for your enlightenment rather than a divine thing outside of the universe. But there still is some sense of a reference point there to the teacher. But it's a human matter rather than a... Notice that the priest or the mullah derives his authority from Allah. The Buddhist teacher derives his authority from his accomplishment within himself at meditation and what he learned. And if he hasn't learned anything, it's not likely people listen to him because he's not talking straight. So it's a question of like the personal a charm and authenticity of the person who sets himself up to be the teacher, as there would be in poetry too, and the charm and the authenticity of what the guy is saying, rather than his imitation of the formula. So that and much of the Buddhist teaching is done through art to begin with. Like every Zen master and every Lama has to master poetry, calligraphy. In Tibet, certain forms of dance, which you know, yogic dancing. In Japan, there's flower arranging and tea ceremony, and all the various art, and haiku writing, but even brushwork painting, both in Tibet and Japan, for the Buddhists, that's very important, because those are means.
Well, pleasure and playfulness and humor, those are things you often think of when you think of religion, isn't it? I mean, the idea of humor and playfulness is a beautiful.
Well, with the St. Francis, sometimes you think of humor and playfulness. You know, with some of the old Western saints have something on the ball. But there's the, you know, the joyous aspect you might read about in Thomas Merton. But that the sense of a sort of almost like fox-like, a trickster hero playfulness is always in indigenous religions, as in Buddhist practice, is a very important element. And that trickster is the mind itself, and you know, playing tricks on you, but creating everything. The trickster, you know, like a coyote created the world by pissing on a rock, according to some American mini Indian myths.
So it's the mind that's tricking and the mind that laughs.
Yes. And Moloch, whose name is the mind.
Well, that's great.
So then the artists, like it's even in music, like Philip Glass, my friend, who we just made an opera together called Hydrogen Jukebox. So he's an old practitioner of Tibetan Buddhist style since 1968, I think. So it's affected music quite a bit. Both in the notion of mantra as a continuous mind stream or a continuous dream repeated and intensifying for that minimalist music, or also as a sense of discontinuity, as the Beatles demonstrated and as others, Cage or others have demonstrated, jumping from one rhythm to another without warning, one theme to another, including dissonance. Anything that you can conceive that you can look at as sacred or aesthetically, then can be integrated into the music too. So we have it in music, in painting, in poetry, theater, and finally in television you have that jump cut, you know, coming from the cinema, montage, which reproduces the activity of the mind itself and makes people examine their own, how does the mind operate?
By not fulfilling expectations with continuity, you realize that you had expectations.
Yes, in that the continuity is the continuity of change rather than the continuity of a linear storyline. A little bit like, I think younger people understand that now through television. Even through television, what do they call it, skateboarding or skimming through the television or surfing?
Right.
What do they call that?
Surfing. I think it's channel surfing with the bipper.
Channel surfing,
with
the
bipper, yeah.
Yeah, and as a source of entertainment. But you can channel surf your mind, too. That's the interesting part. That's what meditation is. You focus on your breath. Try and keep your attention to the breath one way or another. And then you find your mind wandering, and you notice your mind is wandering, and you catch yourself thinking. And you appreciate the gorgeousness and weirdness of the thought and the oddity of it. And then on the next breath that you become conscious, you go back to your breath. So it's going back and forth in this very ancient form of meditation between observing the inside and observing the outside.
Wow.
The outside being the breath going into the air, your own actual breathing, the inside you're spacing out, and always coming back to the place where you are, so the breath, using the breath as the reference point. And there's a form of meditation where you don't even use any reference point, just simply become aware of your thought around, of your thought and of the space at the same time.
That must be a hard one.
Well, that's supposed to be the best. They call it Ati Yoga. I've not practiced that, except intuitively. But there's, I think Soyal teaches that.
Oh, I'd like to learn about that. But often when I'm going to sleep at night, my thoughts dissolve and the images come from, I don't know where they come from, but just they have no earthly reference points. And they just dissolve endlessly one into the other. And it's comforting to know that there's a Buddhist, there's a place in the Buddhist world for that kind of experience.
Oh, well, that's normal. That's a normal mind. But then there's several generations past myself and Kerouac and Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen and Lew Welsh, the poets, that have picked up on this aspect of Eastern thought, as they call it. So you have Anne Waldman is a fantastic writer, poet, whose work is based on a Buddhist notion of the mind, as well as Diane de Prima, another great woman poet. And you have many younger poets who, and I think American poetry is now sort of flavored with a little Buddhist understanding. And so almost all poets have some sense of it. But that's an old American tradition going all the way back to Emerson, Thoreau, and Walt Whitman, that understanding of Eastern thought, or that inquisitiveness into Eastern thought. We even had a movement in America called the Transcendentalists, who were considered the great writers toward the end of the 19th century, mid and end of the 19th century, who actually introduced Indian thought and Hinduism and Buddhist ideas into American literature. And I think our generation is just continuing that old Americanist tradition. After all, America is a melting pot. And now there's another matter, which is that after the Vietnam War, we've got an enormous amount of Eastern folk here, not only Hindus and Indians, but many Japanese, who, because of business and commerce, and also many, many Vietnamese and Indo-Chinese of all kinds, and that has put a new flavor into American politics and into American culture, and I think that's one of the best things that's happened, that we're actually beginning to respect Eastern thought and realize we have something to learn, just as they respected Western Faustian thought and learned a great deal from our mechanical civilization. We are realizing that we have something to learn from the age-old Chinese, Japanese, and Indian civilizations.
Beautiful. It's interpenetration is possible.
Pardon me?
It's our interdigitation.
So why? Because they've got airplanes now. Passage to India is, like $1,000 now instead of like a year on a boat or whatever it was when Whitman wrote his poem, Passage to India. Or so you can get back and forth now. And so people actually physically can go visit Tibet, China, Japan, India, whereas in the days of the Transcendentalists, that was not very likely to happen, that somebody would actually get to India. They might get as far as Heidelberg or Granada, like Washington Irving or Longfellow for education, but not all the way around the world. But now it's easy. It's an 18-hour air trip. So it's a physical thing, and there's the new faxes and communication and scholars going back and forth and diplomacy and wars and Americans, 500,000 Americans in Vietnam picking up on Vietnamese manners and food and Buddhism. So there's an enormous interchange that way also.
Well, it's just fascinating. I love talking to you. I really do. I don't want to keep you much longer because I know how swamped you must be with your schedule and everything.
I just have a little time.
You're so generous.
The other thing is, in painting now, there are a number of very interesting American painters who, second generation after de Kooning and Klein and the abstract expressionists, like the minimalists, Arte Povera group from Italy, that have developed here in America, like Francesco Clemente, who goes to India every year or every 2 years to paint and study and wander around. And lived there as a young man, partly as a fallout of the American beatnik voyage to the East. The Italians picked up on that too. So now there's a whole group of painters like Sandra Chia, Clemente, and the American George Condo, and others who are have an affinity for that kind of thinking, the notion of transitoriness and the improvisation in painting. So there's a, you know, artistically, there's a great powerhouse for Buddhist ideas, and naturally there's a reaction to that on the part of the Christian fundamentalists and the theopoliticians and the television evangelists and the others. And some of them were beginning to characterize Buddhism as some kind of satanic cult or something.
Idol worship. These
religious cults were really cults, worshipping idols in the Christian way, beginning to get paranoid and nationalistic and chauvinistic and hostile. But that was, I think, a passing moment. I think I don't think anybody takes that seriously anymore.
Could I invite you to just give me a couple of verses, if you like, of a poem that reflects some of these ideas, either an old poem or something that you're working on now, to sort of open it up with before I even introduce you?
At 60, well, let me get something out. I got my poetry book here.
Okay, good.
Hold on a second.
Okay, when?
Okay. Well, this combines politics, Buddhism, and poetry. Peace in Bosnia-Herzegovina. General Mother Teresa. Emperor Dalai Lama the 14th, Chief of Staff Thich Nhat Hanh, Army Chaplain John Paul II, followed by the shades of Gandhi, Sakharov, Sartre, and his uncle Albert Schweitzer, went to the bombed-out streets, talked to Muslim Bosnians in the burnt-out grocery stores, parlayed with Croatian and Serbian generals in Parliament, asked them to quit shooting and firing artillery from the mountainside overlooking villages emptied of grandmothers. So now there was quiet. A few fires smoldered in back alleys. A few corpses stank in wet fields. But who owns these houses? The cinema theaters with broken doors? Who owns that grocery store, that city hall, that windowless school with broken roof tiles? Who owns these little apartments? Now all worshippers of Allah pray in towns besieged 100 miles away, overcrowded in tenements and tents, with UN Porto San toilets at the crossroads. Who owns these abandoned alleys and drugstores with shattered bottle shards over the sidewalk and inside the door? Who'll be the judge, attorney, file legal briefs, bankruptcy papers, affidavits of ownership, deeds, old tax receipts? Who counsel who lives where in this rubble? Who'll sleep in what broken-walled hut in the full moonlight when spring clouds pass over the face of the man in the moon at the end of May? So that's a sort of a, I don't know if you could call that Buddhist or not Buddhist, but it certainly has some element of...
It's so beautiful.
So now, maybe I might introduce my own teacher, Gelug Rinpoche. He and I have had a lot of conversations about Buddhism and art.
Good.
And you might ask him what good art is in these later days at the end of the millennium.
All right.
But I'll see, he's downstairs. I'll see if he's free. Hold
Thank
on a second.
Thank you so much.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Is this a good time to talk?
Yeah, that's fine.
Do you have a couple moments?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, it was so wonderful speaking
to you.
Thank you.
No, that's okay. You can talk there. Alan, you can be on that line. Alan's on the line, too.
Oh, great. Hi. Oh, wonderful. So
can you hear both of us?
Yeah, I can hear you both just great. That's wonderful. I was wondering about your views on Buddhism and art. I mean, in some ways, they would seem to be so different. In some ways, when you're talking about the spaciousness and the potential of the mind, they seem to be almost the same thing. I was wondering what you had to say about this. Buddhism and art.
I've been talking about it.
Oh.
Okay.
What I had said is that you and I, that Gelug Rinpoche and myself have had many conversations about it. What is the traditional function of art in Tibetan Buddhists' practice?
Well, I think there's two things. You know, you can look at art as art itself. And actually, if you look at drawing art outside, like a picture drawing, a tanka drawing, mandala drawing, all of those are they actually representing the mind and the capability, sort of giving a picture to the mind what you can really achieve. And that is basically what art represents. And in addition to that, not only what you achieve, and what can you express?
Mm-hmm. Expression, that must be a very key element, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an easy way of expressing it. And so you use a lot of different art forms, the poetry, the drawing art as art itself, the Dharma, the music, and all of them are actually the traditional Tibetan Buddhist way is actually to express and to bring a better understanding and to bring a sort of, you know, breakthrough with communication actually to the other individual, whoever you're talking to.
What is there to express? Both fundamentally, what is there to express? I mean, what needs to be said?
What the complex message, what the Buddhism really carries, the mental development, the how the mind develops, how the individual person develops, what we normally call in the West is a spiritual development, right? And how does that affect to the individual? How it becomes materialized to the individual? And that is a very complex message. And if you can put it in simple words, like, say, love and compassion or something like that, in simple words, it can be simple, but it has really deep meaning in that. So in order to express that, you really do need a lot of... people put a lot of time and try to gain experience, all of them. So art is one of the important methods here, how to get that message across.
So it's almost like you're saying that the things are a symbol, are simply what they are, but they also symbolize what they are.
Things are, it says it is, looks simple, but it's also very complex. You know what I mean?
What do you mean?
Like, say, for example, you said love and compassion. Okay, you just said love and compassion. Compassion, it sounds very simple, right?
Not in my experience.
Yeah, you say compassion, you have good thoughts and have good feelings towards this other, and in that way it is simple. But when in Buddhism, and when you say love and compassion, and then you probably talk what sort of a level, what sort of a category, and there's a lot of level, a lot of categories you're talking about the love. And particularly, we say good compassion. It's almost like having equal compassion to all beings. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean there are no end to the beings, right? Because there are no ends to the mind forms.
Yeah, there may be end of beings, yes. I think there's a limit of beings, the end of beings. The end of mind, too. End of mind capacity, too. But to see and to catch that end is become extremely difficult. But I don't think you can say it's not there. So these sort of complex messages and complex Buddhist development, they what you develop as an individual practitioner to get developed, and that was expressed through art.
That was an interesting statement. What is this terminology about the end of beings and the end of mind? That's intriguing.
Yeah.
Where does that lead to, or what are you thinking in terms of the individual death or the stopping of the mind?
No. I'm not thinking of that. End of beings, even the beings, and even the Buddha was asked, is the beginning of a being? And the Buddha said, I cannot figure out.
Uh-huh.
Actually, so the Buddhist scholars like to say Buddha keep quiet. But actually what he meant is he can't figure out. Will there be end of it? And he said, yeah.
He said, yeah.
Yeah, he said, yeah.
What did he
And it means the individuals, you know, people get out of the samsara and the sufferings, uh-huh. and so they get into nirvana and the peace and the enlightened, and therefore the end of samsara comes.
Yeah, but I, the other slogan I've always heard was samsara is eternal.
Yes, looks like eternal, but it also has a limit and it has its end.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that one before.
That's interesting. Yeah, but see, we had a nice conversation. Yeah.
Well, there was another question. We were discussing whether or not the planet had an end or the human aspect a couple months ago. And we were guessing, well, you know, maybe a couple hundred years we might lose the planet. So I was saying, well, what good is poetry and art then in that case? If there's no immortality, or you know, there's no human race going on and on and on and on for, because we might, you know, burn ourselves out. So Rinpoche's answer was quite interesting. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, I said it is to remove sufferings or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still that the art still had a function.
That's right.
And could you say that again?
Yeah, let's hear more about that.
You want me to repeat?
Yeah. What did you say on the other end of the line?
I said I'd love to hear more about that. I mean, that's a very intriguing thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, what is the purpose? I mean, like Alan was saying, as he mentioned, he said, well, if the world is going to be ended, and what is this purpose? What is there? I said, at least it removes sufferings of the individuals, eliminate the sufferings.
So, in other words, it's better not to have born in a way. But as long as you're born, you might as well get rid of as much suffering as you can.
Yeah, as long as you're born here, you're here, and we have to relieve as much of the suffering of self and others as much as you can.
But how does art serve that purpose?
Art is one of the key. I mean, actually, really, art serves the immediate removing the immediate suffering, and it also conveys the long-term way of relieving the suffering from the individual. Art carries the double message. It also serves removing immediate sufferings, and that we don't have to elaborate. We know that, right?
Well,
music
in what
does.
Sense? Yeah, music
does.
Okay.
Poetry does, and even the artist drawings does, and even the art person who's artist who's drawing, that person does, and person who enjoys that does. That we all know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
That is
the normal body we all know.
The pleasure or enjoyment. But does it contribute? Does art contribute to any permanent insight into the causes of the suffering?
It does.
Yeah.
You know why? It carries a deeper message, like the poetry.
Yeah.
The poetry will carry a deeper message, and what causes suffering. I mean, like you have a lot of poetry on Four Noble Truths. And things like that. And I mean, the sufferings and all this you have. So what causes sufferings? And the of course, the delusions and the ignorance. And I mean, it's almost just like that of Buddha's message itself. It can carry by the art. I mean, I see that. I don't see the ending there at all.
You would think on the face of it that the momentary pleasure that one got from a beautiful piece of music, say, or a poem, might increase suffering because it leads one to think that the cause of satisfaction or the cause of the end of suffering lies outside one. In other words, you might forget that it's really you that's doing it all along.
I don't know whether it's you are the only one who gives all along, but I think the art and the poetry, what the momentarily when you see or read, and you get a relief. And that probably not you. I think the art has contributed to that.
Well, I certainly have a lot to think about.
Yeah, and in addition to that, it carries a deeper message.
Does it carry a deeper message to somebody who isn't aware of the Dharma, for example? I mean...
Some do. You know, they like the tradition. It's such a thing. And a lot of this, even you just look the European art, like the even the medieval and even afterwards, you know, like even the Bangkok, or all this, you know, you call here Bangkok, right? And all these people's messages, if they look in their art, they carry a tremendous amount of a message relating to their sufferings of the people and their difficulties, their life difficulties, experience around there, they do carry tremendously. Hello?
Hello, hi. No, I'm just thinking about what you're saying. I'm just so full.
I'm sorry.
No, that's great. I'm complaining.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because you really see it. You really see that not only the artist himself is suffering, even though they have no dharma or religion's background at all, but, you know, their art, when you look at it, how much expression they give you.
I know that artists tend to suffer quite a bit in creating things. It's sort of like... sort of like giving birth to puppies or something. There's always a lot of blood and body fluids and pain that goes into art as well. So it's interesting that it would have this transformative, it would carry the seeds within itself for its own release.
I mean, when I see the art, and I really see all this, maybe it's the way my mind turned, I don't know.
Sounds like you get a lot of pleasure from everything almost.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't really have any more questions right now. I want to go back and work on the material that I have.
Well,
okay.
And it's very nice talking with you.
It's so nice talking to you. And I really, I'm from the bottom of my heart to both of you, I'm very grateful for the time you took.
Okay. So if you need any more from Rinpoche, you have this number.
I do. And I really thank you very much, both of you.
This is what, the Voice of America?
Yeah, this is the Voice of America. This will go out all over the planet.
You're calling from Washington?
Yeah, I'm calling from Washington, D.C. And it'll be translated into up to 47 languages, but for sure it'll be in Tibetan as well.
Oh,
you'll be translated into
Tibetan.
Tibetan.
Program there. Yeah,
yeah, John Buscher, do you know him?
Yeah, I met him because a couple of years ago they contacted me I don't know what it is, to look through some exam of some people or something.
Uh-huh. Well, great.
Anyway, very nice talking with you.
Nice talking to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
thank you very much, Allen Ginsberg.
Okay,
bye.
I'm glad you got both of us.
I sure am.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.